Good afternoon, everyone. I'm introducing our actuaries here today. We have two from Milliman. Deanna Bell is a principal and consulting actuary with Milliman's Seattle Health Practice. Deanna's focus and work is in Medicare Advantage and Part D Medicaid Managed Care Risk Adjustment, year-end financial reporting, and reserving for health plans and pharmacy benefits. On her left is David Koenig. David is a consulting actuary with Milliman Seattle Health Practice. He's been with the firm since 2010. As a healthcare consultant, David works primarily with Medicare and commercial markets. His clients include insurance companies, provider groups, and government entities. Please join me in welcoming both people.
Well, thank you for coming to our presentation, Medicare Advantage Risk Adjustment Updates and Current Issues. And I've already been introduced, so I can probably skip the same bit that I was saying. But yeah, David and I are from the Seattle Healthcare Practice of Milliman. We're both actuaries. We've pretty much spent our entire careers working in Medicare Advantage and risk adjustment. David and I are also, we collaborate together on Medicare Advantage Risk Adjustment. We've done research studies, we've published white papers, and we work on client projects all the time together. David is actually he owns our own practices risk score tool that calculates risk scores from source files, for those that know, right? It's pretty cool. But yeah, is there anything else that you might want to add? Did I just steal your thunder?
We're grateful to be here, excited to be here with all of you today.
It's our first time at the conference, and I will survey the crowd later, but it was interesting to hear how many shout-outs John Gorman gave to actuaries, and not in the 100% positive light, but it was still like, hey, good people know who we are. So we do want to get you up to speed on everything that's going on with MA risk scores as we slide into the 2021 bid season, and I can't believe it's that time of year again. I guess for us, since we prepare bids, we might be on a different time schedule than from those that maybe use risk adjustments more in the downstream. But for us, the season is about to be kicked off. The advance notice part one on risk scores might drop this month. And then, really, I'd just like to survey the group a little bit before we get started and as people are rolling in. Just because we've never been here, we're not exactly sure what kind of attendance we would get at a session like this that can be pretty technical, but we'll try to keep it light. So how many of you are actuaries or have worked with actuaries in the past? Okay, we've got some in the room that people know who we are. And do any of you prepare Medicare Advantage bids? Oh, we got some in the back. Excellent. And how many of you work directly with risk score monitoring, data submissions, implementing risk score accuracy initiatives? Bunch of you guys, like a lot of the room, I'm glad. And how many of you work in areas that are impacted by risk scores but more in the downstream, like revenue monitoring and financial reporting? Got a couple? Yeah? Perfect. How many are you of you are from CMS? Do you get any CMS at this session? Oh, darn. Okay. And how many of you are brand new to risk scores? Oh, we got one. Well, we'll do our best to make sure that there'll be some takeaways for everyone during this session. I'll use this clicker. So this is just a reminder of the source of the data we worked on and that your actual results will vary from what we present. So we'll just move past the caveats. So we like to stay organized for our short hour here today. We put together a little agenda. David will jump into recent updates in risk adjustment program and to get us quickly up to speed on where we've been the past few years and what happened during the 2020 bid season here this past June. Then I will discuss CMS's RADV audit program changes that came around. Then David will jump back up here and share the results from our RAP CDS survey that we put together from a pretty good group of Medicare Advantage plan data contributors. And then David then will dive even deeper into the Part C model changes that were rolled out in 2020. And then I'll finish up with some recommendations for best practices in risk adjustment. And maybe we'll have some time at the end for questions, so let's get ready to do this thing. I've also included some resources in the appendix to the slides, so make sure to download a copy of the presentation with some, there's hyperlinks to reports, white papers, CMS resources, all sorts of goodies just for you to take home. And I guess now David will take over and talk about recent updates.
All right, thank you, Deanna. Can everyone hear me okay? If you can't, raise your hand. No? All right. All models are wrong, but some are useful. I really love this quote. I try to cite it a lot to the teams that I work with, you know, whenever we're building models or working with existing models as part of the work that we do day to day. I think it's a really good perspective to keep in mind, and I wanted to start our presentation today with this quote so we can all have the right mindset. The CMS MA risk adjustment models, they're complex, they're detailed, they're ever-changing. At some point, if you haven't already had this thought, maybe during this presentation or in the future, you might stop and wonder, you know, are these models any better today than they were last year? Or are all these new changes that we're working so hard to make going to make them any better next year than they are right now? And if you ever think that, I would just challenge you to maybe pause and step back and ask yourself, what does that even mean? You know, what does it mean to make a model better? The obvious answer here in this case might be that it can more accurately predict future healthcare expenditures. And sure, that's part of it, but I think when CMS designed these risk adjustment models, I think they had something a little bit broader in mind. They have shared with us some of their design objectives for these risk adjustment models. As expected, they include things like predicting healthcare costs, as you'd imagine, but there's also some other things that you might find or be interested to know. For example, another design objective is using diagnosis categories that are clinically relevant, encouraging specific coding, and discouraging coding proliferation, and then never penalizing a provider for recording more diagnosis information. So if we focus solely on, you know, predictive accuracy of healthcare costs, I think we're missing kind of the bigger picture of what CMS intends and really what the model was designed to do. So throughout this presentation, if we get to a part where you're thinking about the risk adjustment model and you think, why is this the way it is? Why couldn't we do something different? Usually if you go back to these design objectives that CMS has explained, you'll usually find your answer in there that, you know, maybe it's not going to make things as easy as possible or, you know, might not even affect the predictive accuracy, but some other objective is being completed by the way that the model is. So keep that in mind throughout the presentation, especially as we get into some of the more complex nitty-gritty details. Okay, so to get into the presentation then, we did want to start with kind of an overview of some of the recent changes in the MA program. And specifically, I want to just give a little background to risk adjustment within Medicare Advantage. So as all of you know, I hope, payments within the Medicare Advantage program are risk adjusted. You know, each beneficiary gets a risk score. Those risk scores are calculated, and then revenues adjusted, payments are adjusted based on, you know, the risk scores of the beneficiaries in your plans. Those risk scores are calculated from several data inputs. So specifically, demographic information is used, information like age, gender, Medicaid status, disability status. Another input is the diagnosis information for medical claims. And I do want to take a second and point out here that this is the only medical claims or diagnosis information that's used in any of the risk adjustment models. Even in the Part D model, the RxHCC model, which predicts your Part D drug costs, that doesn't use any drug information. It still goes back to those medical diagnosis codes for the inputs to the model.
And David, the medical diagnosis codes, they come from two different file sources, right?
Yes, so those can be submitted either through the RAPs or through EDS or EDPS.
Encounters.
Yeah, we'll get deep into that in future slides here. And the last thing I want to point out about the data inputs is beneficiaries that are new to the Medicare program, they're scored under separate models, which are demographic only. There's no medical claims or diagnosis information used to calculate their risk scores. The model used is a prospective model, which means that it takes diagnosis information from the prior year to predict claim cost or calculate a risk score for the current year.
So for payment year 2019 that we're in right now, it's diagnosis information from calendar year 2018, which is being used for those scores. And there are three main scores that we talk about. There's the Part C risk score model, which is really limited to just non-ESRD, non-hospice members. There's a Part D model, and then there's an ESRD model for those Part C ESRD beneficiaries. And we talk about each of these models as if they were just one thing, but really each model is made up of a bunch of different model segments, and each model segment can be thought of as almost its own risk adjustment model within the broader umbrella of models. So, you know, even in the Part C model, there are nine different model segments. Six of these are for different different Medicaid status and age-disabled statuses combinations. One is for institutionalized members, and then two are for beneficiaries that are new to the Medicare program. And these models vary a little bit in which variables are used to create a risk score and how much each variable contributes to the risk score, that coefficient that's applied to each variable. The final thing I want to touch on is, you know, each beneficiary gets a risk score calculated three different times. So when the payment year starts, an initial risk score is assigned, and then there are two subsequent updates. There's a mid-year update where that risk score is updated to reflect more recent information, and then there's a final update to reflect even more recent information, more complete information. And those two updates, the mid-year and final, they're accompanied by settlements on the revenue to increase or decrease the revenue according to the risk scores. So that's kind of the high-level background. And with that, we can move into some of the recent changes that we wanted to touch on. So I wanted to start and discuss some of the recent changes to the encounter data submissions. As we kind of referenced or referred to earlier, there are two main ways that diagnosis information gets submitted. In theory, they are relatively parallel processes, although the details are very different between the two. So the two methods are through the RAPS system and through the EDS system. So we're going to be talking about the EDS and the encounter data submissions here. This is just some recent news on the encounter data front. So the first thing I want to talk about is there was a recent settlement for an issue that CMS discovered. They announced earlier in this year that the risk scores were not being calculated properly for to include all of the chart review submissions on the encounter data side. And they also announced that there was an issue with some beneficiaries that had railroad board identifiers, that their full information was also not being included in the risk score calculation. And so CMS identified the issue, announced it to everybody, and then they found a way to address it and correct it, and they started to roll out the fix in terms of updated risk scores and settlements to correct that issue. So for payment year 2019, this issue, the final risk score in the regularly scheduled final risk score settlement will include the fix for this issue. For payment year 2018, CMS just issued a kind of a special second final settlement in October of this year, just 2 months ago, to settle up this issue and to correct, to update those 2018 risk scores. And then for years before 2018, CMS still needs to update those risk scores and pay out any settlement. And they haven't announced the date yet, but that will occur at some point in the future. I put there's a little footnote up in here. Again, it's a reference just to the footnotes in our appendix has links to the CMS memos that describe these issues in more detail. So grab the slides, jump to the back, and you can find kind of the references there. The second issue that I wanted to discuss about the encounter data is there were restated MAO4 files that were released. CMS released initially your January through April monthly MAO4 files, and then later said, oh, you know, there was a technical issue. We left off some valid diagnosis codes, and so they reissued the monthly files from those 4 months. These MAO4 files, they include the diagnosis codes that are eligible for risk adjustment, for input into the risk adjustment model on the encounter data side. So if you work with these, make sure that the MAO4 files that you're using are the updated revised versions and not the original versions. And that was for January through April of 2019. The final encounter data issue that we wanted to just bring up and kind of remind everybody is for payment year 2019 as well as payment year 2020 next year, the risk scores that are calculated using these EDS data inputs, they're going to be supplemented with diagnosis information from inpatient RAPS diagnoses. And so they're going to take all the encounter data, diagnosis codes, they're going to loop in all of the RAPS inpatient diagnosis codes and calculate a score in that way. And this applies for 2019 as well as 2020. As far as we understand it, this is a temporary process and it's not intended to go on forever, but CMS hasn't announced yet how far that will continue into 2021 or beyond perhaps.
So what do we see? It usually cuts the gap about in half between RAPS and EDS when we put the inpatient RAPS diagnosis codes into the EDS side?
Yeah, I think probably a lot of you are familiar with, you know, if you calculate your RAPS or your risk score under RAPS versus under EDS, those scores are never really the same. A lot of our clients that we work with showed lower EDS scores than RAPS scores, and when we added in those supplemental diagnosis codes from inpatient RAPS records, it did seem to cut the gap about in half. So these are some of the, throughout the presentation, we have a few, touch points from work that we've done. And, you know, after the presentation, if you've done these same kind of measurements or have other data points to share, to add, we'd love to hear your, you know, where your organizations are coming in or what your experience has been, how it compares to what we've seen. Moving along then, we do want to talk a little bit more about this transition into the encounter data system. So as we mentioned, RAPS and EDS are the two theoretically comparable parallel ways of submitting diagnosis codes. CMS wants to transition away from RAPS and into a fully encounter data system. And so starting in 2016, they started to calculate risk scores both ways, once under each diagnosis submission system, and then blend those risk scores together in an effort to ease into a fully encounter data world. And so you can see here, this chart shows the percent of each risk score that's calculated based on the RAPS data versus the EDS data, and how that blend has changed over time. So in 2016, it started very small here at 10% EDS and 90% RAPS, and then it's changed throughout the years. The transition has not been a steady kind of one direction kind of thing. It's been a whole thing, but. And we're excited that for 2020 now, we're finally at a point where we're going to be a 50-50 split of RAPS and EDS. Seems like a big deal. Seems like a tipping point of, you know, a risk score being weighted as much on your encounter data as it is on the RAPS data. CMS has not yet announced what future years will look like. We threw out a guess here for 2021. We think it's going to be 75% EDS and then go to 100% in 2022. But we'll have to wait and see what CMS wants to do for that.
There's another comment that I thought of that I remember. So the reason to moving toward EDS for risk adjustment is that, and I think this from just hearing some of the conversations in California, having actionable, high-quality encounter data is very important to our healthcare system and to regulators and to payers alike. And having payments tied up with those encounters is the whole reason that we're going through this multi-year transition from RAPS to EDS, because RAPS data is very limited. There's a diagnosis codes, there's a date of service, and a very high-level categorization of the type of service, inpatient, professional. So this is just tying payments with a very rich, high-quality data source.
So the next kind of recent change that we wanted to touch on is some of the recent model changes. So we want to talk about what's coming for payment year 2020. There are a lot of new models out there, and each model change kind of encompasses different actual changes within that new model. So we put together this grid here. It shows the three main models, Part C, Part D, and ESRD, and some of the ways that a risk score model can change. So as you can see here, Part C is changing in a big way for 2020. The things that we see that are new in the model is payment year 2020 is going to be a blend of multiple models. And so it's going to be partly based on the new 2020 model and partly based on an older model. And we'll get kind of more into those details a little bit later too. It's going to contain the new 2020 model is going to contain new HCCs. These are the hierarchical condition categories, or kind of the main condition groups that those diagnosis codes roll up into. And so there's going to be new ones that will affect your risk score. The variables in the risk score model, the coefficients on those variables will change. So how much, you know, each demographic and condition variable affects your risk score, that will be adjusted as it's recalibrated to more recent data. And then this is the biggest change, in my opinion, for Part C is they've added new count variables. And so now instead of, at the beginning I told you it was just demographic information and the diagnosis code information, there's going to be a new type of a variable in the risk score model, which will just be the simple count of how many conditions the beneficiary has. And then the beneficiary will get an extra bump to their risk score based on whether they have 5 conditions or 10 conditions or whatever that number may be. So this is a new type of variable in the risk score model that hasn't been done previously. It's being added to the Part C model for 2020. So in comparison to the Part C model, the changes... the changes under the Part D model are much less significant. There's not going to be any blending, there's no new HCCs, and there's no new count variables. The only thing that's changing in the Part D model is that there will be new coefficients. So they're going to use all the same variables, and they're just adjusting how each of those variables affects the risk score. And this is pretty consistent in line with the Part D changes that have happened over the last few years to the Part D model.
So David, they just use an updated PDE, Part Prescription Drug Event, file to then use the same coefficients but calibrated to those data.
Yep, yeah, they use the same variables.
Variables, right, so all the same HCCs, but then new cost basis for the model.
Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm. And then the ESRD model, it also has new coefficients, so it's been updated, recalibrated, and there will be a blend. So for payment year 2020, it's going to be a 50-50 blend of the score calculated under the new 2020 model and the prior 2019 model. And all these changes are relative to what was in place in payment year 2019. So this is kind of a high-level look at how things are changing. As you can see, most of the changes, at least on this grid, are in the Part C model. So I want to talk a little bit more about those changes, and then we're even going to circle back one more time before the end of the this presentation to really get into some nitty-gritty details. So this new Part C model for payment year 2020, it's called the Alternative Payment Condition Count Model, the APCC model. It's kind of a mouthful, but that condition count, it just refers to that new count variable that they're adding to the model. And I'll emphasize here that this new model, risk scores are only going to be calculated using this new model from those encounter data inputs. And so all of your diagnosis information from RAPS will continue to be calculated under the old model, which is the 2017 model. And it's the same model that the RAPS scores were calculated on for payment year 19 and 18 and 17. So this new model, it's really a change from the 2019 EDS model to this new 2020 EDS model. And for payment year 2020, as we saw before, they're going to be blending a 50-50 weight the risk scores under this new APCC model with EDS data, and then the prior 2017 model using RAPS data. So that's how they're going to get the final score for payment year 2020. As I mentioned before, there are new HCCs for dementia and for pressure ulcers, and then they added these new HCC count variables, so that's how the actual structure of the model is going to change. And we are going to circle back to a few more kind of nitty-gritty details, but are there any model change questions right now? Okay. Great. So then the last recent change that I want to touch on is changes to the settlement schedule and timing. So I've put together this kind of this grid, this calendar, if you will. It shows the timing for each of the 3 risk scores that get calculated that CMS releases. Across the top row there, you can see the timing for the initial risk score, and then there's the second row is the mid-year update and then the final year update. The shading in here, the gray period is the diagnosis period that's used for those diagnosis inputs, and the blue period indicates how much longer after that diagnosis period ends that the Medicare Advantage organizations can still submit those diagnosis codes, and then the risk score gets calculated and released by CMS at the red kind of the red X's there. So across the first row here, it's kind of hard to get that with the pointer. The initial risk score calculation, it shows that the diagnosis codes used are from July of 2016 through June of 2017. There's a couple of months of run out there for the Medicare Advantage organizations to submit that data, and then CMS published that risk score for the first time in January of 2018. in August of 2018 then, that got updated with the mid-year risk score run. And the mid-year run is updated to include calendar year 2017 diagnosis information. So it rolls that diagnosis period forward. And then in the final settlement, you'll see that it's using the same diagnosis period, but it extends that run-out period of, you know, when Medicare Advantage organizations can submit those diagnosis codes. So they have a full 13 months there to submit the diagnosis codes from that prior calendar year. And the settlement, there's two X's here. The settlement originally occurred in May of 2020, and then there was that second settlement which happened to address that the missing EDS chart review issue, and that came out in October. And so most of this is very typical to how things have been in the past, except for the timing of the final settlements. So the final settlement came out in May, which is much earlier than it's come out in past years. And we'll see that's, we're going to flip to the next year's payment year 19, we'll see a similar trend there as well. The two things that I do want to point out here are for any given beneficiary, their risk score, it can only change at these three points, when the initial risk score is calculated or at the mid-year update or the final update. Even if their demographic information changes, you know, from month to month during the year, their risk score does not change until CMS runs one of these settlement runs and releases updated risk scores. So for any given beneficiary, you'll always see the same risk score kind of from month to month. At a plan level, though, the risk scores will change and drift as new beneficiaries come in and other beneficiaries leave. So at a plan level throughout the year, you'll see plan risk scores shift seasonally, and then they'll get updated on this schedule.
David, these risk scores show up on the monthly membership report files and on the plan pay reports, like the aggregate totals of the revenue?
Yes, the revenue settlements.
So when we have, like, the final settlement, I mean, it already in 2019 that this occurs, how do we see what happens to the 2018 risk scores? So we have, I'm feeding it to you.
So in those monthly membership reports, they get updated risk scores that occur kind of well after the fact here in the final risk score run. They get retroactively adjusted back to the payment year. So back, it reaches back to January of 2018, January through December, and it'll adjust those risk scores and then, you know, pay out whatever settlement is due based on that calculation.
Yeah, they're completely restated at that point in time.
The 2019 settlement, again, looks very similar to the calendar. We see initial risk score in January, and then the mid-year risk score here, it came out in June, which again is earlier than we've seen it in past years. At this time, we don't know the date of the final risk score settlement, so we expect it to be kind of in this May through July time period. But again, the biggest change here is that the mid-year and the final settlements have started to occur more earlier than normal. I think generally Medicare Advantage organizations appreciate this. They appreciate knowing what those risk scores are a little bit sooner. I think the one thing that a lot of the organizations that we work with do also appreciate, though, is knowing in advance when these settlements will occur. Often there's a lot of kind of custom analysis that these organizations perform when they get these settlements. And so I think a few organizations were caught a little off guard and these came through earlier than expected. And I think CMS is committed to letting us know when these will be going forward so that we'll all know when to expect the settlements and we can be ready with whatever types of custom analysis and work that we do.
I have one more question on the settlement schedule. The risk scores for initial, mid-year, and final for payment 19, are they the blend of the RAPs and EDS?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, yeah, for payment year 18 and payment year 19 and going forward, every risk score that you see is going to be the blended risk score. It wasn't always the case. Kind of reaching back through time, there was, again, kind of a rough transition patch there where we went from, you know, a RAPs-only score to a blended score, and there were a lot of moving pieces, but I think that's all behind us now. So every risk score you see here for payment year 19 going forward, they've all been blended appropriately and you know, just according to what CMS has announced for the particular payment year. Yeah. Great. Okay, any questions about these recent changes? Excellent. Okay, I'm going to pass it back to Deanna then, who will talk a little about the RADV audits.
Thank you. All right. So risk adjustment data validation, or RADV audits, is the program that CMS has to maintain the accuracy and the integrity of federal payments to Medicare Advantage plans. And since risk adjustment data translates into revenue to Medicare plans, RADV audits are intended to ensure that the diagnosis codes that are used in risk adjustment are supported by medical face-to-face visits and the records for those visits. And so I have laid out here a goal and a method and the recoveries that came about in 2012 in a document that CMS has put out about contract-level recoveries for RADV audits. And this is something that for the past, since 2011 season, this is something that's been implemented, but one thing I want to caveat with is that contract-level recoveries actually haven't happened yet. You'll see in my next slide that's something that's been proposed as that's something that's going to be changed potentially. So yeah, this method for contract level recoveries involves selecting a sample of beneficiaries, and it's all spelled out like by the number in the CMS memo, and then recalculating their risk scores based on the documentation provided at the time of the audit. And the sample's risk score is then compared to what was paid during the payment year to develop an error rate. And then the sample is used to extrapolate the payment error rate to the whole contract to potentially have recovery. So generally speaking, this is the process to recover overpayments in the Medicare Advantage program, because there's this assumption, even the fee-for-service, that there are errors in the diagnosis coding data that is used in risk adjustment. So I just wanted to see how many of you have been through a RADV audit or are going through a RADV audit right now. Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were a bit slow to start. So there were some much earlier in the program, 2004. Then there was a period where they didn't happen. There were things tied up in courts, so 2007 to 2009. Then there was a memo that came out, and they started them out with a 2011 payment year audits using this methodology I spelled out. And pretty much the audits that have occurred, they've only done the specific recoveries for specific sample cases only, and plans have not known what could be the overall plan contract level, but CMS does have the authority to get the overpayments and recover overpayments on a contract level, not just for a sample set. One of the plans we work with has also just gone through a 2014 audit, no results yet, and they got notice that they'll be doing a 2015 audit as well. So they're starting to roll up, and I guess it can be a really challenging process, and just like any audit, so, and with this contract level recoveries, it could also be very impactful to the bottom line. And I know there's a session in this room right after ours that will dive in even deeper in RADV audits. So stick around for that if this is your area that you work in a lot. So in late 2018, CMS released a proposal impacting the RADV audit program for these contract level recoveries. The proposal is to remove the fee-for-service adjuster from calculating the audit results, and it's a pretty complex calculation that they laid out, but we haven't seen the full details of it yet. They want to apply this back to the 2011 audits because they say we've been doing this sampling method since the 2011 audit, and so the only change is going to be to the final calculated recovery rate for the entire contract. They estimate that the impact will be $1 billion in additional recoveries in the 2020 payment year season. So I think that's based on the audits that they have completed from 2011 to 2013. And then it's going to be about $381 million each year after. So this is coming from the actual proposal, those program-level estimates. At this point in time, there hasn't been a decision about finalizing this proposal, and we know that many organizations commented on it before the August 28th deadline this year. Actually, the deadline for comment was extended multiple times. So it's definitely a hot topic because it's a big revenue impact, and it's recoveries from plans. So lots of stakeholders responded. CMS documented that the fee-for-service adjuster accounts for the difference in the underlying data that they pull from RADV audits, which is claims from MA plans relative to the data that's used to calibrate the HCC model, which are fee-for-service claims that are outside of the Medicare Advantage program. So there's a difference there in the error rates, and they needed that fee-for-service adjuster to account for it. Well, then they released this analysis supporting the fee-for-service adjuster is not appropriate to be used in RADV audits, which is the basis of the proposal. They did this whole thing. So we have a paper included in our appendix from a Melman colleague that explains the CMS's rationale and the analysis from removing the fee-for-service adjuster from the final calculation, but it also includes an independent analysis that concludes that the fee-for-service adjuster is needed. We don't know what the value of that adjuster could be. Our colleague came up with a range, like the error rate of typical errors between 8% and 21%, so just a huge range, very impactful. CMS hasn't, I don't think, released an estimate of the fee-for-service adjuster, what it could be if they went ahead with the using that in their calculation. So that's kind of all up in the air because this is a proposal that hasn't been finalized yet. So we're definitely watching this issue closely, and as I bet a lot of you in the room that work on RADV audits are too. I guess now David will talk about the RAPS and EDS study that we did with a group of our clients.
Thank you, Deanna. So as we mentioned before, risk scores are currently being calculated using RAPS data and then separately using EDS data. They're being blended together. A lot of the organizations that we work for, and I think all the organizations out there in the MA world, realize these scores are not the same. Early on in the transition, a lot of our clients came to us and they were very concerned that their EDS scores are much lower. And so we've kind of been tracking that and helping them in certain ways and watching this across the industry. So we put together, this is the results from our latest study. We want to share it with you today. And again, if you have your own measurements that you've taken at your organization, I'd love to hear about it afterwards, see where you fall on this. I threw up the results here, but let me talk a little bit about where these numbers came from, and then we'll get into what I think these numbers show and what they mean. So back in January of this year, CMS released a summary of risk scores to all the different Medicare Advantage organizations. And our office, Milliman, we pulled a nationwide sample of this data, put it all together. For each plan, we calculated the relativity or the ratio of the RAP score to the EDS score to see how they were similar or different. Overall, we ended up with about 890 different plans that went into this data. There was obviously a range of results from this data, so we wanted to show it at not just the median 50th percentile, but also at the 20th and 80th percentile. We thought that would do a good job of showing the range without really showing any of the real outliers. And then we also wanted to split the results out by plan type, specifically general enrollment plans and then the special need plans, the SNPs. And so so we put this all together. This is the calculations are based on the models in use in the 2019 payment year. And they're based on calendar year 2016 diagnosis codes. So it's kind of a custom summary that CMS had done and released to all the Medicare Advantage organizations. So what does it show? I don't think I can hit this screen over here. Sorry, everyone over there, you're going to have to look over here. I think at the 50th percentile range, I think the high-level result is we see a difference of about 0.04% on average between RAPS and EDS, with the EDS scores being lower than RAPS. But I think we also can see there's a lot of variation within that result. So at the high end, for example, we see a lot of plans that actually have EDS scores that are higher than RAP scores. And then at the low end, we see a lot of plans with a significant gap between RAPs and EDS.
David, how can we have EDS scores that are higher than RAPs?
So RAPs and EDS, I mean, they're conceptually, theoretically kind of parallel processes, but there are a lot of differences. The biggest of which maybe is just the filtering in terms of how you decide what is a risk adjustment eligible diagnosis code. And so the RAPS, under RAPS, it's kind of a set of general guidelines, and under EDS, it's a very specific process that CMS applies. And so to the extent that there are differences in that filtering process, your risk scores are going to come out differently. The other thing I will point out here, I mentioned that these risk scores were calculated, the RAPS and the EDS, using the models in place for payment year 2019, and those were different models. So the RAPS data was run through one model, and then the EDS data was run through a different model. So there could also be some very minor model differences. The one other thing I do want to point out too is the gap is much larger for these special need plans than for the general enrollment plans. So I think we're excited, hopefully this coming spring, to update this with more recent data, the most recent data available. And if we do come up with anything, we'd love to make it public and kind of release it so you can see where you're at and see how your organizations stack up to this, or what to expect throughout the industry, depending on what your job is. So moving on, I want to circle back one more time and do our final kind of deep dive into the Part C model change details. And I promise this will be the last time we talk about it, but it's a big deal within the risk adjustment MA world this year. So I want to touch again in a little bit more detail on some of these changes to the Part C model. As I mentioned before, there are three new HCCs. These are HCC 51, Dementia with Complications, HCC 52, Dementia Without Complications, and then HCC 159, Pressure Ulcer of Skin with Partial Thickness Skin Loss. It's important to note that the coefficients, or how much each HCC contributes to the risk score, it was set equal for the two dementia HCCs because they didn't want any clinical discretion in selecting the diagnosis code to impact payment. So those coefficients are the same, and obviously a different one for the pressure ulcer HCC. Again, the big change this year is these new count variables. And so, as I mentioned before, each beneficiary gets all their data run through. They identify all the HCCs or conditions that beneficiary has. And then a final variable is added to the model, which is just the count of how many conditions that is. The impact to the risk score model varies based on the exact model segment of where your beneficiary falls. But over all the model segments, there's no increase to risk score for people that have between 0 and 3 conditions. And so the increases don't start until you have at least 4 conditions. 4 through 9, your risk score increases as the number of conditions you have increase. And then it caps out at 10. So you get a risk score bump for 10 HCCs, but it's the same if you have 10 or 11 or 15 or 50. It doesn't keep increasing after that. As I mentioned before, this is specific to the Part C model, so it doesn't apply to the ESRD or the Part D model. And CMS has told us that this change to the model came specifically to comply with some regulations in the 21st Century Cure Act. This required that the model take into account the total number of diseases or conditions of an individual enrolled in an MA plan and make an additional adjustment as the number of diseases or conditions of an individual increases. And so I think CMS looked at that. They said, what can we do? And this is what they've come up with. I did want to show you just kind of the real nitty-gritty actual example here of what we're talking about in terms of risk score increases. So this is a table of the actual risk score coefficients by HCC, or by HCC count. And it's broken out, again, by these 6 different model segments that it applies to. So up here you can see the segment definitions for each of the different population combinations, and then the rows here indicate how many conditions the member has. So between 1 and you get up to 10, 10 plus. And I'll just use, I think, the non-dual disabled as an example. So you can see that there's no risk score increase for between 0 and 4 conditions. But then starting at 5 conditions, you get a 0.043 bump to your risk score. That goes up by about 0.09 at 6 conditions. And then as you go from 6 to 7, it goes up by about 0.07. And then 7 to 8, there's a large jump. It goes up by about 0.24. And then from 8 to 9, it stays the same, no increase. And then 9 to 10, it goes up again by a large jump, about 0.46. And then it's capped out at 10 right there. And you can see kind of a similar progression of coefficients through all the different all the different model segments. It's not a smooth progression, so adding one HCC, it really depends on where you are and what you're going to in terms of what the effect on the risk score is. And this is because CMS calibrated this to real data. The data was real, it was kind of noisy, and I think CMS took care to make sure that there were no negative coefficients, so risk scores wouldn't go down if you had a certain number, and that your risk score would only increase, so at each level it stays the same or goes up, it never drops back down. So CMS kind of took care to make sure this made sense, but they were working with real data, and it's just a little bit messy. So that's why you get these kind of uneven stair steps as your number of conditions increases. Any questions about these, the count variables, the results? Yeah, let's go here and there. Mm-hmm. So generally, CMS said they didn't want to start adding coefficients at the really low levels because they were running into just the variables weren't statistically significant, and they were getting a lot of negative coefficients there. And so to kind of make sure that it made sense, it would indicate an increase in cost, they kind of wiped out those low levels. You're right. I mean, it does, what is low kind of depends on your model segment. So for HCCs counts in the non-dual age, but it doesn't for, you know, any of the other ones, and full dual age doesn't start till 6. So I think it's all just kind of a product of the data they were using, and this desire to make sure it was meaningful. If you think just statistically, I mean, these variables they're highly correlated with the actual HCCs that are still used in the model. So statistically, this is kind of a challenge to use these in the model. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Lydia Meekley from Memorial Care. I do risk adjustment provider education. And I just want to make sure I'm understanding. So it doesn't matter which HCCs are counted as long as there are 6 or 7 or 8.
Exactly. Yep.
Fascinating.
Yep. Yeah, it could be cancer, AIDS, could be anything. It's just a simple count of them. Yeah.
Hi, my name is Yosef Bogdanoff. I'm from CareMore Anthem. And so have you guys done any data analysis on how that actually affects risk scores? Because we've done a little preliminary analysis, and so sort of like a waterbed effect, as they raise these risk scores for the APCC and count HCCs, they lower coefficients across the majority of common chronic HCCs. So it essentially is like it's a perception of increase, but more of a wash overall.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. If you're looking at these and thinking CMS took the model and then is just layering on higher risk scores for everybody, that's not what happened. So as you add a new way to increase a risk score, just like you said, I mean, you're going to take that out of somewhere else. And so all of the coefficients were kind of rebalanced, and generally, adding a new way to get risk scores increased here means you're going to take away some risk score somewhere else. So yes, I mean, to your point, I can show you the best thing that I have here. This is our best shot at results, kind of on a nationwide level. This is a little messy as well, but I'll tell you what I see in here. This came from that same survey of data that we used to put together the RAPS to EDS gap results. So it's the same kind of 890 plans. These were scored under the 2020 model, the APCC model. It has the count variables, as well as a 2019 model. And so it's an EDS 19 to 20 model change. And we put here, kind of on the vertical axis, it's the percent change moving from 19 to 20, whether your risk score is going to increase or decrease just due to the model, not due to normalization, not due to different membership mix or diagnosis information or anything. It's just a straight model change. So that's what we put on the vertical axis here. What we see, I mean, there's some noise and stuff kind of up here, but generally all the plans here are clustered kind of between plus and minus 1%. So especially plans within kind of a normal risk score range. Across the bottom here on the horizontal axis, we thought it'd be interesting to see how the risk scores changed from the model based on where the starting risk score was. As we saw increases for members with more HCCs, we thought, is this going to really shift? Is going to benefit certain plans more than others, depending on the risk score. So we spread that out across the bottom here, so you can see starting risk score and then what the model change impact was. And again, I mean, in this kind of, I hate to use the word normal, but in this general normal range of plan risk scores from 0.5 to 1.5, it's a pretty consistent plus or minus 1%. At the high end here, if you get over like 2.0 in your risk score, you do see more increases than decreases. We didn't get too much into the why of this. We suspect these plans are generally smaller and they were kind of outliers to start with having such a high risk score, and probably more likely to fluctuate more with any change just because they generally have fewer beneficiaries enrolled in the plan. They're also probably benefiting more from that 10-plus bump to their risk scores. So But this is kind of the look that we're having. And again, if you've kind of run these numbers and looked at a 2019 to 2020 model change for your own organization, I'd love to hear what you came up with or what you think and how it compares to this. All right, so that's the Part C model change. Are there any last questions about that before I turn it back to Deanna? Excellent. All right, Deanna.
This is the last section in our agenda where we talk about best practices. And here I've laid out a visual for some of the best practices that you may consider. And these are things that you're probably already doing. And we hope to talk to you after the session to find out if there's anything else you may be doing to help maintain the accuracy of your risk scores and make sure that you're keeping up to date with all the payment year changes that come along every year. So right up at the top, it's best to calculate MA risk scores on a regular schedule. As David mentioned, CMS will calculate risk scores 3 times for a particular payment year, but the intervals that the risk scores are calculated and then posted on the MMRs may not be frequent enough for you to make sure there were no missing diagnosis codes or any breakdown in the data submission process. You don't want to be surprised in this area, so having more real-time risk scores to monitor has many uses, like developing estimates for full year, payment year revenue for financial reporting, or to understanding differences between 2 payment years beyond just the changes in risk scores that CMS publishes. Next one there is, since there are 2 separate data sets sent to CMS, RAPS and EDS, it's best practice to calculate and monitor both sets of risk scores. When EDS was first being phased in, many plans only focused on the RAPS-based risk scores and didn't spend as much time on EDS. Well, now in 2020, we have that 50-50 blend, which means a plan must understand why one data source is producing risk scores that are different from another for the same member. They're both important. So if EDS is still a challenge relative to RAPS, calculating risk scores for both sources and comparing them to each other is a good best practice. And theoretically, the risk scores should be fairly similar, and only small differences in risk adjustment filtering should account for the differences, and not any missing data. Although I must put another caveat in here, now that RAPS and EDS scores are calculated on 2 different models, it's more complex to do the comparison and understand the differences between the 2 scores. So one method is to calculate RAPS and EDS risk scores using the same risk score model. And it's not like, it's only once a year that you'll get your RAPS and EDS risk scores from CMS separated out. Usually they already combine on the MMRs. So beyond that, you're gonna need to do the exercise yourself. So I think personally, I would run them on the same model to really capture what could be triggering the differences. The next one we have here is CMS has been releasing the EDS report cards to monitor the flow of EDS records through the various error checking and editing processes. So review these reports on a regular basis to ensure there's no hiccups in your process and the issues are addressed in a timely basis. These reports also include benchmarks that CMS created for a comparable plan, so it's a great tool to measure your own performance. And I just wanted to know, how many of you look at the report cards? Couple of you over there. There's some over there. That's good. And do any of you find the information actionable? Are they handy? Yeah? Some? Kind of? Yeah. Yeah, really, I think you need to really dig in and do your own risk scoring to understand what's going on. So EDS records have a lot more elements to them and many more ways to break down and get kicked out through the complex editing process. And since EDS will be the sole source of risk scores in no time, it's best to invest into a robust error handling process and team. I know we've talked about not all plans have those resources, but we have seen Medicare organizations invest heavily in their own data analytics and informatics teams to make sure that they can roll with the changes and provide real-time tracking, correcting, resubmitting key performance indicators. Okay, chart review data can have its own challenges. We've seen in the past that chart review initiatives are not always implemented in time or chart review data is not submitted in the proper format to be included in final risk adjustment. So plans should monitor their submissions of chart review data, confirming that the records are accepted for risk adjustment. And you should also monitor to see that the resulting change in risk score is in line with internal best estimates. So these initiatives can have quite a cost to them. Monitoring the ROI of the chart review submissions is also an important exercise. Finally, benchmarking and reviewing your own results compared to expectations is a good way to identify any other issues beyond data submission process breakdowns. Risk scores do not change with expectations, and I'll show you later a type of analysis that visually we can look at that. Then there might be time to dig in and make changes to submissions before the final deadline happens. So benchmarking yourself to a previous year or to a group of other benchmark data is a way to make sure that you're keeping up with the never-ending task of submitting accurate diagnosis data in a timely manner. So let me show you some visuals of what we've looked at. All right, I'll speed it up. Okay, at the top, we have an example of how to monitor RAPS versus EDS data. And here, what I'm showing is for a particular group of HCCs. This is the cancer HCCs. I have them lined up by their hierarchical order, where we have the most severe conditions at the top, just like CMS orders it. And you can tell by the coefficient, usually they have the highest values. And what we did is we summarize the data about for each member whether they had that HCC flagged in one data source versus another. And really, what if we were trying to track and test for equivalence between the two sources, we really want that diagonal to be the highest, close to 100% of members having a match between the two sources. Then we really know that there isn't really anything huge going on in your EDS program that's maybe messing you up. In the upper orange triangle, this shows areas where the potentially EDS has lower severity HCCs that are triggered for the same member relative to RAPS, or no diagnosis code at all that supports a cancer HCC. So this is a really nice way to just reduce the huge burden of trying to figure out why your risk scores are different, is just by focusing, okay, why is EDS producing a lower RAPS for just a lower risk score an HCC just for this particular member. So just breaking it out. Another version to look at here is we take the difference between RAPS risk score and EDS risk score and bucket them up by severity. And really, the top part, the orange part, is where we see the biggest differences in RAPS risk scores being higher compared to EDS. And again, we're trying to get to equivalence, so the zero bucket would be the best case, is try to make sure you have the most scores that agree with each other between the two data sources. But again, that's another place I'll caveat that if you're calculating them under the two different models, by default, they're going to be slightly different, 1% or whatever. But if you don't want to go through the practice of calculating them under the same model, you should still see a bit more clustering around the smallest differences in risk scores. And here I have another example of something that you could potentially implement, and that's monitoring your risk scores via data warehouse. So I mentioned calculating risk scores on a regular basis is the best way to catch issues and make sure there's enough time to actually act on them. And the data warehouse can bring that information together all in one spot. So we show a data warehouse where we bring together the latest MMR risk score, a risk score calculated from submitted and accepted RAPS or EDS records. And I only have one column, but you should have two, one for each one. And then a risk score is calculated from source claim files. So this is your one source of truth, and potentially from where RAPS records are being created from and encounters are being created from. What you want to do on the source data side is make sure that it's filtered before you calculate the risk score to align with RAPS guidelines or EDS filtering logic that's been published. So you're in a way creating a proxy risk score that's RAPS or EDS that just has the latest, greatest information. And here you can just catch differences. You can see that MMRs are usually lagged. You only get them 3 times a year. Submitted and accepted also has a bit of a lag, and that could be where you discover some files that weren't submitted or completely kicked out. And then the source data, this is where ultimately this is your source of truth, and it's just a really great way to monitor. Another thing is, like, it's a great tool to inform stakeholders that maybe have just been focusing on MMRs their whole time, to help them understand that this is all going to catch up. We have these submitted and accepted records. Our risk score is actually this and not that. So just explaining the differences via something like a data warehouse could be really powerful. There's just so much going on here. It's no wonder we need so much data and brain power to keep it all straight. And here's a visual of monitoring the average risk score glide path or completion percentage. The blue line here I have is a potentially a year ago a glide path for a plan, and the orange one is this year's. And this shows me the monthly average risk score compared to the final risk score as we keep adding one additional month of files that were submitted and accepted to CMS. And you can do it on a RAPS basis, EDS, whatever. So as you can see, the risk score starts out pretty low relative to final, as very few records have been submitted to date. Then it grows and grows until it plateaus at the final risk score. So you can monitor your glide path for risk scores. You can compare multiple years together, multiple data sources, because in a way we're going from something that looked like it was like 40% to 100% ultimate final risk score. So, yeah, one thing that we want to note here is that we did not limit the membership to like a longitudinal data set, so this may not work well if you're experiencing a lot of new enrollment or have a fairly small plan. A prior year's glide path might be completely different from what you're experiencing, just of the variability and result in something that's a particularly small membership base or one that's growing and changing dramatically, or maybe there's a lot of disenrollment. So it might produce some questions if you do this and find out this is like it's doing its own thing this year. So I think we've reached the end of our content. Please check out the appendix. We've got the citations. We've got the hyperlinks to cool reports and white papers and CMS resources for you. And do we have a couple minutes for, oh, we've reached 4 o'clock, right on time. But yeah, this completes our presentation. If you want to stick around and ask us questions, we'll be here. Thanks.
Thank you.